Well, good evening and welcome to the Coop, both newcomers and repeat offenders. You know, if you look around here, you notice that there are a great many rather ponderous and impenetrable books out there in the world. That being the case, it's always refreshing to find one whose scope and whose impact are in inverse proportion to its length and its heft. I think The Tipping Point is one of those books. You know, from time to time, and usually it's quite unexpected, a work appears that acts as a kind of sinus decongestant for the brain. You know? One strong spray and the intellectual passages sort of clear up, even if you weren't aware they were blocked in the first place. Suddenly we find we can grasp things around us that we've always been looking at. We grasp them more sharply, and the effect on the reader can be rather intoxicating. Once again, this is that kind of book. One of the delights I find of The Tipping Point is that Malcolm Gladwell asked the kind of question that a child might ask, the kind of question that's sort of on the tip of our brain, like a name of the tip of the tongue, and that often we find it hard to focus on, not despite its obviousness, but because of it. And the question he asks here is one that once we've heard it asked, we say, gee, why didn't anybody think of this before? Namely, what makes things catch on? What makes things take off? Ideas, products, fads, trends, fashions, cultural phenomena. And I think you may find, like I do, that the simplest questions often require the most difficult answers, or at least the answers that are most difficult for an author to articulate. And I think it's to Malcolm Gladwell's credit that he has given us an answer in a book of very modest size, as you can see, but of rather immodest, I think, art and insight and even elegance, if you've read it, you know what I mean. As they say, it tastes great and is good for you at the same time. Like the phenomena that Malcolm talks about in his book, The Tipping Point itself has caught on and has taken off. Now, I don't know what the sales figures are, for instance, for Daytona Beach, but here in Cambridge, where the life of the mind is generally considered second in importance only to the fortunes of the Red Sox, this is a hot book. Tonight, Malcolm will talk about the book, do some reading from it perhaps. We'll open it up to your questions and his answers and a general discussion. Those of you who would like to buy a copy of the book, and I should say that as The Tipping Point is now on the National Campus bestseller list, it is available for 40% off, can come up at the end of the presentation and our guest will sign a copy for you. With that, it is my honor and my great pleasure on behalf of the Coop to turn the floor over to Malcolm Gladwell.
Thank you very much. That was a very generous introduction. As I've gone around the country, I sometimes ask booksellers for tips about how to best do a reading. And one person told me that, it's sort of telling me what not to do. She said that a guy who'd written a whodunit had come to their bookstore and had at a reading had read the last three pages, and he then wondered why no one bought the book. So I will not be reading the last three pages of my book. I'm going to read a couple of short segments to give you a flavor for some of the things I'm trying to do here, and then I'll take questions and things. This is a book about applying the lessons of disease epidemics to social change. And in the course of it, I discuss a number of weird and interesting and provocative, I think, examples of epidemics. And this first section I'm going to read from is about an epidemic that took place in the South Pacific that I think is a really allows us to, or permits us, if we think about this, to think about epidemics in our society a little differently. Not long ago, on the South Pacific Islands of Micronesia, a 17-year-old boy named Sima got into an argument with his father. He was staying with his family at his grandfather's house when his father, a stern and demanding man, ordered him out of bed early one morning and told him to find a bamboo pole knife to harvest breadfruit. Sima spent hours in the village looking without success for a pole knife, and when he returned home empty-handed, his father was furious. The family would now go hungry, he told his son, waving a machete in rage. Get out of here and go find somewhere else to live. Sima left his grandfather's house and walked back to his home village. Along the way, he ran into his 14-year-old brother and borrowed a pen. 2 hours later, curious about where Sima had gone, his brother went looking for him. He returned to the now empty family house and peered in the window. In the middle of a dark room, hanging slack and still from a noose, was Sima. He was dead. His suicide note read, "My life is coming to an end at this time. Now today is a day of sorrow for myself, also a day of suffering for me. But it is a day of celebration for Papa. Today, Papa sent me away. Thank you for loving me so little, Sima." In the early 1960s, suicide on the islands of Micronesia was almost unknown. But for reasons no one quite understands, it then began to rise, steeply and dramatically, by leaps and bounds every year, until by the end of the 1980s, there were more suicides per capita in Micronesia than anywhere else in the world. For males between 15 and 24, the suicide rate in the United States is about 22 per 100,000. In the islands of Micronesia, the rate is about 160 per 100,000, more than 7 times higher. At that level, suicide is almost commonplace, triggered by the smallest of incidents. Sima took his own life because his father yelled at him. In the midst of the Micronesian epidemic, that was hardly unusual. Teens committed suicide on the islands because they saw their girlfriends with another boy, or because their parents refused to give them a few extra dollars for beer. One 19-year-old hanged himself because his parents didn't buy him a graduation gown. One 17-year-old hanged himself because he'd been rebuked by his older brother for making too much noise. What in Western cultures is something rare, random, and deeply pathological has become in Micronesia a ritual of adolescence with its own particular rules and symbols. Virtually all suicides on the islands, in fact, are identical variations on Sima's story. The victim is almost always male. He's in his late teens, unmarried and living at home. The precipitating event is invariably domestic, a dispute with girlfriends or parents. In 3/4 of the cases, the victim has never tried or even attempted suicide before. The suicide notes tend to express not depression, but a kind of wounded pride and self-pity, a protest against mistreatment. The act itself typically occurs on a weekend night, usually after a bout of drinking with friends. In all but a few cases, the victim observes the same procedure, as if there were a strict, unwritten protocol about the best way to take one's own life. He finds a remote spot or empty house. He takes a rope and makes a noose, but he does not suspend himself as in a typical Western hanging. He ties the noose to a low branch or a window or a doorknob and leans forward so the weight of his body draws the noose tightly around his neck, cutting off the flow of blood to the brain. In Micronesia, the anthropologist Donald Rubenstein writes, these rituals have become embedded in the local culture. As the number of suicides has grown, the idea has fed upon itself, infecting younger and younger boys, and transforming the act itself so that the unthinkable has somehow been rendered thinkable. Suicide images, Rubenstein writes, are widespread in certain Micronesian communities and are popularly expressed in recent songs composed locally and aired on Micronesian radio stations. A number of young boys who attempted suicide reported that they first saw or heard about it when they were 8 or 10 years old. As suicide grows more frequent in these communities, the idea itself acquires a certain familiarity, if not fascination, to young men, and the lethality of the act seems to be trivialized. Especially among some younger boys, the suicide acts appear to have acquired an experimental, almost recreational element. There is something very chilling about this passage. Suicide isn't supposed to be trivialized like this. But the truly chilling thing about it is how familiar it seems. Here we have a contagious epidemic of self-destruction, engaged in by youth in the spirit of experimentation, imitation, and rebellion. Here we have a mindless action that somehow, among teenagers, has become an important form of self-expression. In a strange way, the Micronesian teen suicide epidemic sounds an awful lot like the epidemic of teenage smoking in the West. The rest of that chapter is an attempt to look at our problem with teenage smoking, which is also epidemic at the moment, has been rising quite dramatically in recent years, through the lens of the Micronesian teen suicide epidemic. And the idea is that these are both expressions of the same fundamental impulse in adolescent cultures. They're both these kinds of self-destructive behaviors. Now, they're obviously played out in different ways. But I think if you can understand the ways in which a very dramatic form of self-destruction has become epidemic among teens in Micronesia, it can help us to better appreciate what is going on with a less dramatic, but equally problematic epidemic in our own country of teen suicide. I also think that this model is a very useful way of thinking about Columbine and the wave of school violence, which is another example, I think, of an epidemic of self-destructive behavior, which has come to take on a certain ritualized significance for teens. The really interesting thing about the Micronesian teen suicide epidemic, as you get into it, is the extent to which the act itself has come to be surrounded by all these layers of symbolism and meaning and ritual, and the fact that they all do it in precisely the same way is incredibly important. Smoking obviously has that element. It's part of the reason smoking is so powerful, so seductive for teens, is that it comes with a whole culture attached to it. Well, the thing that worries me most about the epidemic of school shootings, of the wave of school shootings in this country, is the extent to which these acts have now become to take on that same element. It's no longer just teens going in and shooting. Columbine was scary precisely because there was all of this sort of, all these layers and layers of ritual and culture attached to it. The trench coats, the particular computer culture those kids came out of. It also makes you wonder about the role of the media and all of that. And about, I mean, if this is in fact a contagious, if Columbine represents a contagious epidemic of self-destructive behavior, does that mean that we ought to be talking about it in a different way? And should we be mindful of the extent to which those of us in the media, and I'm, of course, implicating myself here, the way in which you represent that act in, are we aiding and abetting this sort of ritualization process by the way we think about it? Anyway, so that's one chapter. It's, I realize it's a fairly kind of heavy subject to start the evening off. Much of the book is on a much lighter tone, I assure you. But I just thought, I mean, as I've thought about, I wrote this before Columbine, and this part of it has always sort of resonated with me, because I just thought that if you read into these accounts of what happened in Micronesia, the parallels are just so kind of eerie and striking with what's going on here in this country. The next thing I'm going to read is, I have a whole chapter on what I call stickiness, and the idea is that for an idea to become contagious, or to become epidemic, it must be more than contagious. The cold virus is highly contagious, but we never talk about epidemics of the common cold, because the cold doesn't stay around. It comes and goes. It doesn't, you know, you can still go to work. We talk about epidemics of the flu, because the flu, you're home sick, and you're on your back, and you remember it. And the difference between the flu and the cold is the flu is sticky. And I think ideas that succeed succeed for that same reason. They have some additional quality that makes them memorable. That's sort of a banal observation, but what's interesting about that observation is if you then look at successful epidemics and try and figure out what made them sticky, you get into all kinds of cool areas. And the chapter that I talk about stickiness is a chapter that is concerned with children's television, in particular Sesame Street. And the idea behind this chapter is that Sesame Street succeeds as in creating a learning epidemic because the people who founded that show paid extraordinary attention to this idea of stickiness. They were obsessed with stickiness. They wanted to find out a way not just to hold the attention of kids, but to hold their attention in such a way that they remembered what they were seeing and learning, that what they were seeing and learning was sticking into their brain in some profound way. So there was an incredible attempt at the time in the late 60s, and much of the work was actually done here at Harvard by, not that people at Harvard need any more kind of evidence of their superiority, but much of the work was done here by Jerry Lesser at the Education School and Barbara Flagg and a bunch of other people. But they spent a lot of time figuring out how do the brains of three-year-olds work, you know, because if you know how their brains work, then you can start to design information in such a way that it makes an impact on their head. They would do, and I describe in this chapter all of these kind of really cool things that they do to sort of to engineer, I mean, every second of that show is engineered, to engineer this show so that it made this extraordinary impact. And what I'm about to read is a little section on the efforts of a guy named Ed Palmer. Now, Ed Palmer was this guy who sadly just died a couple of, you may have read his obit in the Times a couple of weeks ago. He just died. If you talk to people who are involved with Sesame Street, they will say that Ed Palmer is one of the real heroes of that show. He was the research guy who devised all these ways of figuring out how to make the show sticky. So what I'm going to read is a little section where I talk about Ed Palmer's big idea. And I will mention, in the course of this, I will also be quoting Jerry Lesser. So when I say Lesser says, you'll know. Palmer's innovation was something he called the distractor. He would play an episode of Sesame Street on a television monitor, and then run a slideshow on a screen next to it, showing a new slide every 7.5 seconds. We had the most varied set of slides we could imagine, said Palmer. We'd have a boy running down a street with his arms out, a picture of a tall building, a leaf floating through ripples of water, a rainbow, a picture taken through a microscope, an Escher drawing. Anything to be novel, that was the idea. Preschoolers would then be brought into the room, two at a time, and told to watch the television show. Palmer and his assistants would sit slightly to the side with a pencil and paper, quietly noting when the children were watching Sesame Street and when they lost interest and looked instead at the slideshow. Every time the slide changed, Palmer and his assistants would make a new notation so that by the end of the show, they had an almost second-by-second account of what parts of the episode being tested managed to hold the viewer's attention and what parts did not. The distractor was a stickiness machine. We'd take that big-sized chart paper, 2 by 3 feet, and tape several of those sheets together, Palmer says. We had data points, remember, for every 7.5 seconds, which comes close to 400 data points for a single program. And we'd connect all those dots with a red line so it would look like a stock market report from Wall Street. It might plummet or gradually decline, and we'd say, whoa, what's going on here? Other times, it might hug the very top of the chart, and we'd say, wow, that segment's really grabbing the attention of the kids. We tabulated those distractor scores in percentages. We'd have up to 100% sometimes. The average attention for most shows is about 85 to 90%. If the producers got that, they were happy. If they got around 50, they'd go back to the drawing board. After the third or fourth season, I'd say it was rare if we ever had a segment below 85%. We would almost never see anything in the 50 to 60% range anymore, and if we did, we'd fix it. You know Darwin's terms about the survival of the fittest? We had a mechanism to identify the fittest and decide what should survive. Not only were they doing this with... The distractor is actually quite a familiar thing now in television, but it was invented by Sesame Street. In fact, one of the cool things about Sesame Street is that an incredible amount of research about television and ideas about how to make television work starts with Sesame Street and moves into kind of the mainstream from there. You could argue, I think, legitimately, that Sesame Street is the most important television show ever in terms of its impact on the way television is structured. Anyway, so I'll continue on with this little... The most important thing that Palmer ever found out with the distractor, though, came at the very beginning, before Sesame Street was even on the air. It was the summer of 1969, and we were a month and a half from air date, Lesser remembers. We decided, let's go for broke. Let's produce 5 full shows, 1 hour each, before we go to air and see what we've got. To test the shows, Palmer took them to Philadelphia, and over the third week of July, showed them to groups of preschoolers in 60 different homes throughout the city. What we found, Lesser says, almost destroyed us. The problem was that when the show was originally conceived, the decision was made that all fantasy elements of the show be separated from the real elements. This was done at the insistence of many child psychologists, who felt that to mix fantasy and reality would be misleading to children. The Muppets, then, were only seen with other Muppets, and the scenes filmed on Sesame Street itself involved only real adults and children. What Palmer found out in Philadelphia, though, was that as soon as they switched to the street scenes, the kids lost all interest. The street was supposed to be the glue, Lesser said. We would always come back to the street. It pulled the show together. But it was just adults doing things and talking about stuff, and the kids weren't interested. We were getting incredibly low attention levels. The kids were leaving the show. Levels would pop back up if the Muppets came back, but we couldn't afford to keep losing them like that. Lesser calls Palmer's results a turning point in the history of Sesame Street. We knew that if we kept the street that way, the show was going to die. Everything was happening so fast. We had the testing in the summer, and we were going to go on the air in the fall. We had to figure out what to do. Lesser decided to defy the opinion of his scientific advisors. We decided to write a letter to all the other developmental psychologists and say, we know how you guys feel about mixing fantasy and reality, but we're going to do it anyway. If we don't, we'll be dead in the water. So the producers went back and reshot all the street scenes. Jim Henson and his co-workers created puppets who could walk and talk with the adults of the show and could live alongside them on the street. That's when Big Bird was born. What we now think of as the essence of Sesame Street, the artful blend of fluffy monsters and earnest adults, grew out of a desperate desire to be sticky. It's this wonderful illustration of one of the themes of this book, that little things can make a big difference. Big Bird saved Sesame Street. without Big Bird, that show as we know it, and all of the kind of revolution in television that we've seen over the last 25 years may never have happened. It wasn't until they added that extra element that the kids finally got interested in the part of the show that they desperately needed to be interested in, which was the street scenes with the adults. And it's such a wonderful illustration as well of how you don't know what will make something work until you. I mean, this is another one of the sub themes of the book, that a lot of the times the little extra critical element is something that you could not have anticipated. And sometimes the difference between something being a complete failure and a raging success is something incredibly subtle and seemingly insignificant. You wouldn't have thought that Big Bird is all that stands between a failure and a dramatic success, but sure enough, it is Big Bird. So whenever you see Big Bird, you can. The last section I'm going to read is from the first section. The first section of the book is all devoted to a discussion of what word of mouth is. And the idea behind this is borrowed from epidemiology. In epidemiology, one of the driving principles is that epidemics turn out to be created and generated and sustained by an incredibly small number of people. And I give a couple of case studies of epidemics that demonstrate this. That we think of epidemics as a function of the behavior of a large group of people, and that's not true. It was, for example, with HIV. It was commonly supposed in the early 1980s that AIDS tips among the gay communities of San Francisco and New York because of the high levels of sexual activity among many members of the gay community of those cities, right? That was the assumption. Well, that's wrong. It tips because of the extraordinarily high levels of sexual activity among a tiny, tiny fraction of the gay community of that city. And that observation is very consistent with the way epidemics work. All epidemics have that weird function. So I took that idea and I said, well, word of mouth is an epidemic. Word of mouth is a social epidemic involving some piece of information as a virus. Let's examine and let's suppose that same principle is true, that there are a very, very small number of people who are way out there who are driving these epidemics. And I decide that there's three groups, I call them mavens, connectors, and salesmen. And I go and I find people who demonstrate each of these character types, and they have these long profiles of them, and they are really kind of these wild, hilarious, weird people. And the idea is that weird people rule the world and drive the world. What I'm about to read to you is a little section with a third of these categories, the salesmen. Salesmen are people who are unusually persuasive. And I try and figure out, what is it that makes somebody persuasive? Clearly, highly persuasive people play a key role in starting generating social epidemics. Because some of us are on the sidelines. I didn't go to see Titanic willingly. I went because I was dragged there by somebody. And that's true of many social epidemics that we join. We join them because someone out there convinces us. And people who are incredibly persuasive, I think, represent this really interesting and unusual and significant personality group. So I set about to find who was the most persuasive man in America. And as I asked around, it turns out the most persuasive man in America is a guy named Tom Gow. And Tom Gow is a financial planner in Southern California. And he's so good at what he does that he's down to like 4 days a week, 4 days a month of working. And he has some house up in the hills where he spends most of his time hanging out. He only has to work, the barest minimum now. And there are all in that world, there's a whole kind of world of people who are obsessed with charisma and salesmanship. And he is the man that they all worship. So I paid a visit to Tom Gow to figure out, why is Tom Gow this extraordinary character? And at this point in the chapter, I'm not going to read you the whole Tom Gow section because then you wouldn't buy the book. But I'm going to read to you, at this point in the section, I've been hanging out with Tom Gow, and I'm talking about this idea that when people talk, they engage in this kind of dance, very elaborate, very subtle dance. In fact, if you look at two people when they're talking and you videotape them and you slow the videotape down to like, 1/1000th of a second, you will see that people interact in this kind of weird way. If I was talking to you, you and I would start to synchronize our movements. And, as I move my shoulder some tiny bit, your shoulder would sort of move in harmony with me. Our voices would fall into a kind of rhythm. And one of the ideas that I'm pursuing is that people like Tom Gow are incredibly persuasive because they dictate the terms of that dance. So if you think about, you know, when Elvis Presley went on tour in, the end of the 50s, when he was this kind of extraordinary charismatic figure, if you had gone to one of his concerts, everybody would have been in tune with Elvis Presley, right? I mean, you would be swaying along with him, and every move he would have made, you would be moving along with him. Well, the idea is that there are Elvis Presleys in one-to-one conversation as well. The same thing can happen in the course of an ordinary conversation with someone who has that same kind of charisma. So anyway, I'm struggling with why this guy, Tom Gow, who is this, he is not the kind of person to whom I would normally be, drawn irresistibly. He's a financial planner from Southern California. He's got a big mustache and he wears like cowboy boots. But within 5 minutes of meeting him, I want to, sign over my entire assets to him. So, and believe me, this is not, I came in fully, all of my cynical, hardened, Lower Manhattan journalist impulses were, front and center. And still I was like, Tom, So the question was, why does Tom Gow blow me away? I'm picking up in the middle of this discussion about this kind of synchrony and about the special powers of Tom Gow. When two people talk, they don't just fall into physical and oral harmony. They also engage in what is called motor mimicry. If you show people pictures of a smiling face or a frowning face, they'll smile or frown back, although perhaps only in muscular changes so fleeting they can only be captured with electronic sensors. If I hit my thumb with a hammer, most people watching will grimace. They'll mimic my emotional state. This is what is meant, in a technical sense, by empathy. We imitate each other's emotions as a way of expressing support and caring, and even more basically, as a way of communicating with each other. In their brilliant 1994 book, Emotional Contagion, the psychologists Elaine Hatfield and John Cacioppo go one step further. Mimicry, they argue, is also one of the means by which we infect each other with our emotions. In other words, if I smile and you see me smile and smile in response, even a micro smile that takes no more than several milliseconds, it's not just you imitating or empathizing with me. It also may be a way that I can pass on my happiness to you. Emotion is contagious. In a way, this is perfectly intuitive. All of us have had our spirits picked up by being around someone in a good mood. If you think about this closely, though, it's quite a radical notion. We normally think of the expressions on our face as the reflection of an inner state. I feel happy, so I smile. I feel sad, so I frown. Emotion goes inside out. Emotional contagion, though, suggests that the opposite is also true. If I can make you smile, I can make you happy. If I can make you frown, I can make you sad. Emotion, in this sense, goes outside in. If we think about emotion this way, as outside in, not inside out, it is possible to understand how some people can have enormous amount of influence over others. Some of us, after all, are very good at expressing emotions and feelings, which means that we're far more emotionally contagious than the rest of us. Psychologists call these people senders. Senders have special personalities. They are also physiologically different. Scientists who've studied faces, for example, report that there are huge differences among people in the location of facial muscles, in their form, and also, surprisingly, even in their prevalence. It's a situation not unlike in medicine, says Cacioppo. There are carriers, people who are very expressive, and there are people who are especially susceptible. It's not that emotional contagion is a disease, but the mechanism is the same. Howard Friedman, a psychologist at the University of California at Riverside, has developed what he calls the affective communication test to measure this ability to send emotion, to be contagious. The test is a self-administered survey with 13 questions relating to things like whether you can keep still when you hear good dance music, or how loud your laugh is, or whether you touch friends when you talk to them, how good you are at sending seductive glances, whether you like to be in the center of attention, and things like that. The highest possible score on the test is 117 points, with the average score, according to Friedman, somewhere around 71. What does it mean to be a high scorer? To answer that, Friedman conducted a fascinating experiment. He picked a few dozen people who had scored very high on his test, above 90, and asked a few dozen who scored very low, below 60, and a few dozen who scored very low, around 60, and asked them to fill out a questionnaire measuring how they felt at this instant. He then put all the high scorers in separate rooms and paired each of them with two low scorers. They were told to sit in the room together for 2 minutes. They could look at each other, but not talk. Then, once the session was over, they were asked to again fill out a detailed questionnaire on how they were feeling at that instant. Friedman found that in just 2 minutes, without a word being spoken, the low scores ended up picking up the moods of the high scores. If the charismatic person started out depressed and the inexpressive person started out happy, by the end of the 2 minutes, the inexpressive person was depressed as well. But it didn't work the other way. Only the charismatic person could affect the other people in the room with his or her emotions. Is this what Tom Gow did to me? The thing that strikes me most about my encounter with him was his voice. He had the range of an opera singer. At times he would sound stern, at times he would draw lazily and easily. Other times he would chuckle as he spoke, making his words sing with laughter. In each of those modes, his face would light up accordingly, moving easily and deftly from one state to another. There was no ambiguity in his demonstration. Everything was written in his face. I couldn't see my own face, of course, but my guess is that it was a close mirror of his. Later, I called Gow up and asked him to take Howard Friedman's charisma test. As we went through the list, question by question, he started chuckling. By question 11, I am terrible at pantomimes, as in games like charades, he was laughing out loud. I'm great at that. I always win at charades. Out of a possible 117 points, he scored 116. But, so there's a little taste of that first section on word of mouth. But I'd be delighted to, I could keep reading, but then once again, I'm simply undercutting your incentive to to actually read the book. But I'd be delighted to take questions, and if anyone has any about some of the things I've read. But, sure.
What are the one or two things that you regret most that didn't make the final edit, but that you really liked?
Oh,
stories
that I left
studies
out.
Studies that you left out.
Well, I had originally. I have the personality type that gets carried away with things. And so I got very carried away with the Sesame Street chapter, for example. And it was, at one point, it was this huge, massive kind of deconstruction of the Sesame Street phenomenon. And I regret, actually, it's a shame that some of that stuff didn't. I mean, it had to go. But there is all this, for example, I'll give you one little taste. One of the really cool things about Sesame Street is that Jim Henson, and I have a little bit of this in the book, but not a lot. Jim Henson was picked for that show because he was in advertising. And he had like the hottest ad shop on Madison Avenue in the 60s. And the idea was that if Jim Henson can sell, and a lot of the Muppets actually were originally developed as corporate pitchmen. I think that it was a version of Big Board who was the LaCroix dragon. He sold LaCroix soy sauce. And I think Grover was originally developed to do work for IBM. But the idea was, if this guy can sell soy sauce in 30 seconds, then he can sell the three R's in 4 minutes. And that was why they wanted Jim Henson on board. And the whole ethos, I mean, it's all part of this kind of obsession with advertising in the 60s. And the show, they thought at the time they did that show that the most effective way to reach a kid was in, they were so carried away by what they thought was the power of advertising, that they were essentially trying to make learning commercials, which is why in the beginning of Sesame Street, it's all those very, very short segments, because they're duplicating the commercial. And one of the things I do in the chapter is to go on, I'm now completely off your point, but is to talk about why Blue's Clues is a better show than Sesame Street. And one of the things that Blue's Clues does is it abandons this idea of the commercial and goes for a continuous narrative. And it's a return to a more traditional storytelling. But anyway, I sometimes regret that I couldn't have had a much more complete, obsessive discussion of my favorite subject, Sesame Street. Any other questions? Sure, in the back. Or you in the white shirt there.
Yeah. You had an article in the New Yorker a while ago on the Cool Hunt. Mm-hmm. Was that the germ of this, or what was?
No, there's very little. The germ of this was an article called The Tipping Point, which was just about crime in New York. It was trying to explain why crime in New York had fallen so quickly. And that came out in 1996. A version of that article, a very small version, a much changed version, is now a chapter of the book. Cool Hunt was, there's a little bit of the Cool Hunt in this, but not really much. It's most of this book is about 85% new. Sure.
I hear that you, I've noticed that you have a website, at least listed in the New Yorker.
Yeah.
And you carry some of your writing on the website.
Does everything I've written for the New Yorker is on my website.
I see.
Blavel.com.
So how does that work when it comes to selling your books or selling things if all your writing's on the web?
Well, this is new, and the book is not on the website, so.
Right.
But
how does it work, integrate into making a living as a writer?
Well, I think it's good because it, we were nothing in the New Yorker was on any kind of archive, and so stuff was disappearing, which I thought was silly. I just think it helps. I mean, I want people to, for example, a lot of colleges use New Yorker articles in their syllabus, and it's just much easier for them if it's on a website and they can just tell students to go to the site. That's how a lot of people are using my stuff, and it just helps in, keeping my articles around. I don't like them to disappear. Sure.
It may be too soon to tell, but do you think something as small as splitting your website will help the publicity of your book, or how would that apply something as small as that to a phenomenon of marketing or promotion?
Well, the web, this is actually a very interesting question, because I think that there is a lot of, I think that the usefulness of the internet in what we're basically talking, the larger question here is, how useful is the internet in starting word of mouth? That's really, from my own experience of my website, I've learned a couple of things. One is that as an actual mechanism, if you go to my site, you can buy my book through the site. I actually haven't sold many books that way. Way fewer than I would have thought, given the number of hits I get, and I get tens and tens of thousands of hits. But what I think it does do is build a kind of general awareness of who you are. So when people go into a bookstore, or they might buy it some other way. I think that's actually generally true. I'm quite skeptical of people who think that the internet is a kind of magic communications tool. I also wonder that as we get more familiar of it and the novelty wears off, I wonder, and also as it gets increasingly colonized by people trying to sell you things, like me, I think its usefulness begins to diminish. My suspicion is a lot of the excitement. I mean, one of the things, I'm fascinated with word of mouth because word of mouth, what makes word of mouth powerful is that these characters like Tom Gow and these people I call mavens and connectors, they are important in generating word of mouth epidemics because they are our friends and because their interest in us is altruistic and disinterested. The maven, who is the person who has, the maven in my kind of terminology is the person who has, gives you advice, who knows a lot about stuff. They are totally motivated by this desire to help. But the minute that the maven is kind of enlisted in some desire or is financially implicated in the advice they're giving, their power disappears. The reason I go to certain kind of people for advice on, what computer to buy is that they're not getting a piece of, they don't have a lot of Dell stock and they're trying to show, And what's going on now with the internet with a lot of marketers is they think they can take that mechanism and transport it into a commercial environment without losing any of its effectiveness. And I think that's a mistake. And I think we're about to kind of find out how much of a mistake that is. Sure. And
I read an article about a month ago in Attaché saying that you carry a notebook around, like wherever you go, like a little notebook, and you just write down like every little fact you hear. Is that how you came about writing this book?
This is an article. The question was about it was alleged in an article about me that I carry a notebook around and write down everything I hear. I do that sometimes. I believe that the information acquisition process is social, and that you always get your best ideas from talking to people. I do kind of find myself often in conversations with people on the airplane in which I'm, just on the way over here. In fact, this always happens to me. I was sitting next to some guy who, because I, didn't bring anything to read, I was like, people pester you. Well, I'm one of those pesterers. It turns out you can actually, you'd be amazed at how many totally interesting people are out there who do things that you would never. This is a guy who made all of his money going to companies and saying, I will, if you let me in to take over your, why am I telling you this? but anyway, it was very interesting. But sure.
Were you finished?
You want to hear? Okay. This may be old hat to some of you, but I'd never heard this before. He goes to companies, he says, if you let me go in and just rejigger your lighting system, I will split the savings with you. So he walks in, and apparently the amount of money people waste on lights is phenomenal. Like, he could go in here and just redo the lights, and it would save, $20,000 a year, and he would kick back 10 to Barnes & Noble, and he'd keep 10 for himself. So great. I was like, I wanted to, it's like, can I invest? It sounds so fabulous. Anyway. I feel I'm biased against this part of the room. Are there any questions? Well, maybe I'm correctly biased against this. Sure.
What was your favorite part about the process?
Of writing the book? Mm-hmm. Well, like, it was the most fun thing was when I was doing the first part about the word of mouth, and I had these sort of special people who I think play a critical role. Hanging out with those people was just like so much fun because they're weird. I mean, part of the reason they're powerful, I think I said earlier that weird people run the world. I think that's true. And it's only until you hang out with them at length that you realize how profoundly weird they are. Like this guy, I had so much fun with this guy who's my kind of maven, who's this guy called Mark Alpert, who's a, who is such a maven, in fact. He's this kind of know-it-all. And there's a whole field of research in marketing right now called, that concerns market mavens. And the field exists, is entirely, was started by former grad students of this guy, Mark Alpert, who's a professor of some other field of economics. They all worked, got their PhD with this guy, and at the end they were like, he's so weird, there must be something in this. So they started a whole field basically inspired by this guy, Mark Alpert. And he is truly strange in a fabulous way. And it was just kind of fun to hang around with these kind of characters. I mean, and the book is sort of full of these characters. But I like that. I find it very exciting to kind of find and... I mean, it's one of the great things about being a New Yorker writer is I essentially write stories that are always about the same thing, which is some really remarkable, cool person. And... you know, I concoct some excuse to write at length about them. Sure.
What did you learn from writing the book that has perhaps changed your life or changed the way you do things?
It's interesting. Well, I guess one of the things I learned was to stay with this theme about these remarkable people, this notion that a small number of very remarkable people kind of run the world is something that I had never thought of before. And when it's been a kind of a mind blower for me because one of the interesting things, there's a section of the book where I talk about these connectors are people who know everybody. And I was hanging out, I sort of found a lot of these people and hung out with them. And what you realize, what to me is, revolutionary about that fact is we have so convinced ourselves at this moment in history that the important people are the people who are, first of all, very, very rich, secondly, very, very smart, and thirdly, you know, live in the biggest houses or drive the fanciest cars. We're in love with this notion right now that influence is all about status, socioeconomic status. And what you realize when you look very closely at the dynamics of word of mouth is that influence has nothing to do with status. That influence is a kind of randomly distributed personality trait, and you can find influential people anywhere. And there was this great moment in the book where I describe, I go to Baltimore and I was hanging out with these public health guys who were trying to start a kind of safe sex, anti-drug epidemic among the heroin addicts of Baltimore. And they had identified within this community of people who, and it's just about the most desperately poor, bleak, depressing, disadvantaged community you can find in this country. They had identified within the community of heroin addicts a bunch of guys who were these charismatic, people, energetic, motivated, altruistic people. And it made you realize, you know, they're everywhere. And we have to find a way to fall out of love with this notion that it's all about power and wealth and there was a moment a couple years ago. The reason I got onto this whole thing was, I don't know how many of you are regular readers of my work in The New Yorker, but there was a moment when I was writing only articles about middle-aged Jewish women. I had like 7 in a row or 5 in a row. And it was because I became convinced that, in this very similar kind of theory, that if you read magazines are all about old men and young women. You ever notice that? It's phenomenal. We could go to the magazine rack, and I swear to God, we could make a list of all the articles, and at least 80% would be about men over the age of, say, 45 and women under the age of 25. No one ever talks about middle-aged women. But if you think about it, as a group, a woman who is, say, 65 right now has in her lifetime seen more change than any other, almost any other demographic group at any time in human history. It is this incredible moment and we never ever write about these people. And so I went and I did all these stories, and my most fun one was this one about, I don't know if any of you wrote it, about hair dye, the women who did all of the, because, and the whole point of that article was there was this woman, this totally amazing woman called Herta Herzog, who is now in her 90s, who was a Viennese-trained, basically a shrink, who comes to America in the 30s and goes to Madison Avenue and starts this whole way of thinking about market research on Madison Avenue. And the thing that got me, that blew me away about her was, I went to visit her. She lives up in the Alps. And it was like snowing, and I had to put chains on my car, you know, and the people were like skiing next to me as I wound my way up. But, and she was on a, she's on like a oxygen machine now. She's, because it's, the air is so thin, and she's 90 years old. Anyway, so, and she could only talk for 2 hours. So I flew all the way over there, and I got 2 hours with Herta Herzog. I mean, she's lying there with the oxygen machine. And she's just, she's still, you know, this brilliant woman. And she showed me this picture. She worked for McCann Erickson starting in the 40s. You know, one of the great Madison Avenue ad firms. She showed me a picture of the Christmas party of McCann Erickson in 1948. And it's, everyone's in black tie. It's at the Waldorf Astoria, right? And it's a room full of maybe 300 people. 299 of them are men, and one is a woman, Herta Herzog. And that tells you, that speaks volumes about this woman. It was a completely closed men's world. And she just busted in because she was brilliant, and she's still brilliant. And who's writing about her? You know, no one is. Everyone's forgotten Herta Herzog. And what are they? We're celebrating, you know, David Ogilvy. Well, how hard was it for David Ogilvy to become head of an ad agency? You know, not that hard. How hard was it for Herta Herzog to become? Sorry, I'm getting carried away. But point is, there are these amazing people out there, and we overlook them because they don't fall into the normal categories. We have this obsession with these incredibly, I think, wrong and boring categories about what makes someone interesting or important. I'm still trying to find a question from over here. Sure.
Can I ask what you think about how much damage you've uncovered with people who think they're mavens and aren't, or people, you know, people become addicted to giving advice.
Yeah.
So do you ever find, like, the professor who was Jewish yet knew where to get the best ham for Easter?
Yeah.
Are there ever instances where people just don't want to say no, so you ask him a question and he just answers and he's not sure,
yeah,
but you have so much faith in him that people let astray?
Sure. The question was about mavens. Can mavens, the advice givers, go too far? And the answer is, oh, absolutely. And there is a, I mean, part of being a maven, I think, is to be slightly, at times, annoying. I mean, they're know-it-alls. But I don't think we can live without know-it-alls. I mean, I think that's the price we pay for having people who, and I think this kind of person is becoming more and more important. I don't think you can, how can you make your way now, these days, in the marketplace without a know-it-all on your side? It's impossible. How can you make your way through the internet without a know-it-all on your side? It's like 10 million sites, all like, you know, buying ads and like yelling at you and telling you, I can't remember more than about 6 dot-coms at this moment. I'm so overloaded. We need these people, even when they are sometimes annoying, and even when they're not infallible also. But I mean, I don't think we have much alternative. In the back, in the red.
Your article about the tipping point, the mm-hmm. way long ago one about crime, has anybody ever come to you and picked up on the observation that you made there that the implications for public policy, for example, you don't know that it's an incremental improvement in things, and the idea that you may have to devote an enormous amount of resources to something before you begin to see a result? And
yeah.
Has anybody ever kind of picked up on that, or is there any studies that have happened, maybe not necessarily as a result of what you wrote, but something in that mm-hmm. area?
Well, there's a lot of interest, and it predates my observation in the academic world with this very fact. What has not happened, which is a shame, is that these ideas, this notion, has been picked up by in the political realm for obvious reasons. This is not a moment in American political history when there is much interest in the idea of determining what an adequate level of social investment is, right? It's sort of a hard sell at the moment. And that's a shame. I mean, I think that the most obvious one is Head Start. We know that certain kinds of interventions in preschoolers are effective. We know that Head Start is not as effective as we'd like it to be. But the difference between the ones that we know, the pilot projects that we know that work, and Head Start is not that great. And to me, there's a real opportunity there to try and find that maybe there is a tipping point that's just above what we're spending now on Head Start. But, you know, I cannot imagine how anyone could go to Washington right now and argue for an increase in Head Start funding. I mean, it's sort of hard to imagine, isn't it? I mean, sure.
I think in some ways we've been talking about the tipping point as tipping towards something positive. And I worked for 4 years on an internet site, which was a health education site, a really big one. And because it was new, there was a lot of change within the system. People who monitored the site, people who were running it, the companies that absorbed it and took it over and everything. And the people that I was working with were people who had a certain kind of illness which caused them a lot of depression. It wasn't a recognized illness. They felt very ignored. Mm-hmm. And they were always running into the issues of being anonymous. And yeah. as a result of being an invisible and an anonymous, as well as these radical quick changes that were going on, they would go through these periods of real hostility towards each other, and the whole system seemed like it would tip over and fall apart instead mm-hmm. of tip in a direction of being more and more productive.
Yeah.
And I felt that the people who managed the site were not aware of this and didn't know how to deal with it. And I suspect this kind of thing happens in all of social structures.
Yeah. But
was definitely happening there at a very rapid rate, cycling in and out of hostility and the edges of mm-hmm. despair.
No, I think that's a really important point, that when you think about one of the lessons of thinking about change as epidemic is that epidemics are incredibly volatile. And occasionally we benefit from that because, like crime in major cities in this country, crime can literally almost, you know, plummet overnight. Way faster than we ever thought possible. But it also means that these changes can reverse very, very quickly. This kind of volatility in social change is something that if we think that we are entering a period, as I do, where social epidemics are going to become far more prevalent, we're going to have to expect precisely what you were talking about, this kind of volatility and cycling between two extremes. More and more often. And it's not a model that we're terribly good at diagnosing, and it's not something that makes us feel very comfortable.
One of the things I came away from in the book is that testing is important. And do you think enough testing goes on? Do you think it gets locked away in graduate schools? It seemed like an important thing.
I got very taken with the question was about testing and the importance of, and particularly when it comes to assessing the stickiness of something, that is something that can be empirically determined. And I think we do far too little. We pay far too little attention to that. I mean, I tell a story in a book of this famous study at Yale about trying to get students to get tetanus shots, and they play with every variable, you know. 20-minute course on the dangers of tetanus, a 10-minute course, a thick book, you know, scary photos, non-scary photos. Turns out the thing that really made a difference was whether they included a map with the package that showed them how to get, where to go to the health center. That's a classic example of an addition. That was the tipping point. That was the little thing that made the message sticky and take off. Who would have known beforehand that it was all about the map? We were so obsessed with the big issues, we forgot the little one. There's a very important lesson there for any kind of communication, and that is you cannot predict in advance what the tipping point is. You've got to go and, in some cases, systematically search for it. And the history of social epidemics is replete with examples of the weirdest, like Big Bird. Who would know that they needed Big Bird before you went and tested? I can imagine if they did Sesame Street without the Big Bird change and noticed that kids weren't learning and tested, they would have changed a million things before they would have bought a Muppet onto the set. They would have thought, maybe they would have rethought the fundamental pedagogical premises of the show. They would have questioned some of the, you know, cognitive psychological assumptions, and they would blah, blah, blah. But like getting Jim Henson to dress up a guy in a bird suit would be the last thing on their mind. But that's what made the difference, you know. So testing absolutely is a critical way in the back.
This may be a bit of a digression, but it, you know, being the 75th anniversary of the New Yorker, I was just wondering, how did you end up at the New Yorker, and what has the culture of the magazine done to change you and the way you write since you've been there?
Well, how did I end up at the New Yorker? I ended up at the New Yorker because I was working for the Washington Post, and then Tina Brown started systematically hiring people from the Washington Post, and she went down the list, and finally she hit me. How has it changed? Well, it has changed. I mean, the fundamental way is that they give you, you know, endless space. It's amazing how good someone can look if you give them 7,000 words. You know, it's really hard to write a really intelligent 3,000-word article. It's a lot easier, actually, to write a really intelligent 7,000-word article. So just that kind of permissive culture. And also, the quality of editing is just so amazing. I mean, you have no idea how much... You have no idea the difference between what I turn in and what finally appears is. I mean, it's... I actually should, you know, have my editor write. In fact, if this reading was the embodiment of the New Yorker culture, it would be like, you know, when people speak in a foreign language and they have a translator, my editor would be here, and I would be here, and I would whisper into his ear, and he would fix it, and then speak. Sure.
Back to the internet. Do you think that there's some application to your, to the notion of epidemiology, to the infatuation with the internet and with high technology that we're seeing currently?
Well, they're clearly, I mean, I steer clear of any kind of financial stuff in the book because I don't know enough about it, and if you saw my own finances, you would probably agree it was a wise decision. But there is clearly a strong epidemic element to, I mean, just these kind of wild market swings. This has been sort of explored with all the parallels to tulip bulb mania and all this kind of stuff. And the volatility is clearly has a kind of epidemic quality. The thing that worries me is that what epidemics do, if you think back to that example I gave of the teen suicide epidemic, what epidemics do when they are in motion is to create a kind of alternate reality for those who are caught up in it. That's the real danger of it. The kids, the weirdest thing about them, what happened in Micronesia, was this notion that kids were experimenting with suicide. And I talk on that chapter about all these cases of kids who wanted to try it out. There was a moment, in other words, in the middle of this epidemic, the notion of that suicide was a lethal act had become kind of unhinged from the act itself. Like they had somehow, they were somehow in a place where that wasn't part of it. It was just this kind of epidemics do that to those who are caught up in them, and they can profoundly warp reality. And that would be my big worry about any kind of epidemic enthusiasm for tech stocks is, you know. Is this just simply reflecting the internal logic of the epidemic, or is there some kind of grounding to reality? Sure.
Is there anything that you have, any lesson from the tipping point that you have applied to help the tipping point achieve the tipping point?
Yes, as a matter of fact. Me and my publisher decided that we would try and identify the mavens, the book mavens in the country. And so we made up a long list. Mostly it was people who run independent bookstores. It was a lot of people in the Northwest. A lot of word of mouth bestseller books or successful books that have a strong word of mouth component come out of the Northwest. So we basically sat down and made this long list of people, and we went out there in January and we sent them copies of the book and we bought them lunch and tried to turn them on to the book. I don't know whether, maybe, I mean, the book's doing well, and I'm assuming that had some role in it. But that was our kind of attempt to enlist the power of word of mouth on behalf of this book. But I mean, you know, like anything, it's very hard to know what value it had. But I think it had a lot of value. I mean, I think there are some booksellers, particularly in that part of the world, in book club country. Book clubs, I'll talk about book clubs in my book, actually. Play a really key role in fermenting word of mouth, and if you can generate excitement in that part of the world that's obsessed with book clubs, namely the Northwest, I think it really helps the cause of a book.
On a lighter note, as an editor myself, I kind of like your reverence for your editor. Have you started plans for your next book yet?
I have an idea.
Do you have a book proposal?
Yeah, but I have a little germ. But I can't say what it is. No. It's better than this one.
Does it take off on this book, or
no,
is it completely different?
It's very different. Oh, it's not, there'll be no kind of, you know, return to tipping point, more tipping point, rules of the tipping point. I'm fascinated by Barry Sears, who's like done 17 versions of The Zone. He's now on, you know, a week in the life of The Zone. I was like, what's next? Like a month in life, or like 24 hours in The Zone?
Did Tina Brown carry on the better qualities of the New Yorker tradition?
Yeah, I'm a big Tina fan because she hired me. I mean, so in as much as I represent, I would like to think, part of that process of, no, I'm kidding. I think so. I think actually Tina restored the original purpose of the magazine, which was to be, it was in its, the DNA of the magazine was to be something that was vital and on the cutting edge and concerned with, you know, what was going on now, as opposed to, I think it got too far in the kind of sleepy, I think what she did was very important, and I think she restored its soul. Sure.
Along that same line, are you getting, can you share with us the response to the new editor, since I can't ask you your opinion of him? I'm interested in the response that is public knowledge, because I happen to like the magazine a great deal more since the new editor has come
in. I think David has gotten a really wonderful response. He's such a mensch. I mean, he's different from Tina. And those differences, I will simply say this, he is different from Tina, and those differences manifest themselves in obvious and in obvious ways. Should we, I don't know how long I'm, who's in charge? Other than me. I guess I'll take a couple more, and then I'm sure I'm stretching people's patience here. Sure.
How come it took so long after your book was announced for it to come out?
Oh, it was done, and it was delayed, and my editor was the same guy who edited George Stephanopoulos's All Too Human, and that naturally took precedence over my book, rightly so, and so it got delayed for just kind of boring technical reasons. Should I take one more question? Sure, right there.
Do you find yourself, since writing the book, seeing or predicting tipping points left and right, as I do after reading the book?
It is a little. You can get kind of. It's what I refer to as grad student's disease, which is when you're in the middle of the dissertation, the entire world fits into the ideas you have formulated about 17th century, you know, English lyric poetry. Yes, in fact, I do see them everywhere, and I'm hoping that this particular pathology will come to an end before all of my friends kind of disown me. anyway, well, thank you very much, and I'll guess I'll sit here and sign books. You might need some more, don't you think?
Yeah.
Okay.
On behalf of the Harvard Coop, I would like to thank Mr. Gladwell for being here tonight, and thank you all for coming. We'll see if we can get more seating next time, and have a good night.